Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of the Scared to Dance podcast with me, your host, Paul Richards. Over the course of this series, I've been talking to some of my favourite people about their musical passions past and present. These include people who've DJed at our club night, as well as those who've created our film nights. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Lewis Maynard and Tom Dowse from Dry Cleaning to the show. Emerging from South London's post-punk scene, Dry Cleaning have carved out a space entirely of their own. Minimalist yet charged, angular yet deeply human. With jangling guitars, propulsive rhythms, and Florence Shaw's deadpan spoken word vocals cutting through like a scalpel, they transform everyday observations into something hypnotic and profound. Breaking through their early EPs Sweet Princess and Boundary Road Snacks and Drinks, they catapulted into the mainstream with their debut album New Long Leg. Their brilliant second LP, Stumpwork, followed in 2022, and they join me today to discuss their fantastic new album, Secret Love. Hi, Lewis and Tom. How are you today?
Oh, very, very well, thank you.
That was terrible time for me to put a big chunk of my hair in my mouth. And as you said, are you ready? And I was like, yep.
Yep, can I eat my hair?
So the last time I saw you, Lewis, you DJed at the club with Florence. How was that for you?
It was great. We both dressed up. I dressed up as Devo. She just dressed up as a nun. We had a great night. We got quite drunk.
It was Halloween, I should add.
Well, it was Halloween. Yeah. And then I went to an after party in a morgue.
In a morgue?
Yeah, which was very eventful.
Can I ask why you ended up at a morgue?
Nope.
Okay. And looking at your playlist from the club, you mentioned Devo, but we had The Four, Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Funboy 3, Kate Bush. How do you and Florence decide what you're going to play? Do you kind of have a similar taste in music, or are you both kind of bringing different things?
I think when it comes to kind of like a club kind of like yours, me and Flo share quite a lot of like mutual kind of like interests. But I think in our late teens, early 20s, we went to the same clubs a lot. In London at that time, like every night of the week, there were certain clubs that everyone went to. So it'd be kind of like you'd go to White Heat, you go to Trash, you go to After School, then kind of after a few years, like maybe in our early 20s, you go to Frog and kind of like there's all, every night of the week, there was a particular club. So I feel like we share a lot of interest from that time of like, especially that kind of like indie music time. Mm. But that time was playing a lot of kind of like 80s music as well.
Yeah, it seems wild to think that there were clubs on a Tuesday.
I know, yeah, and it would be round.
Yeah, it doesn't happen anymore. So was that shared love of music or the same similar type of music something that brought you guys together as a band, or were you just like hanging out before the band?
Yeah, we were friends. I met, well, Lewis and Nick have known each other for 20 years, their anniversary this year. And I knew Flo for about 7 years before we started the band as well. So, and these guys knew Flo from years before that. So we were kind of, music wasn't really like the focus of our friendship, really. We were all just sort of going to the pub and just being mates, really. So, but obviously sharing our musical interests and the bands we were doing separately at the time was part of that, you know. I think the thing that sort of started the band really was the fact that me, Nick and Lewis were all sort of winding down a project and we were all working and just had time and fancy doing something that felt more just fun, like just being in the garage, if you know what I mean. Like how when we all started playing music, you just imagine yourself in a garage. You just start by grabbing an instrument and getting in the garage and playing together. So we wanted to do something that was more focused on that, really. And then from that conversation about what music would feed into it started there, really. But before that, we'd go to shows together, you know. Me and Lewis probably cross over a bit more because we like things like Sleep and Sabbath and stuff like that. So we'd probably be more inclined to go to something like the Black Heart in Camden and see a show than maybe Nick and Flo would. But at the same time, Flo, I was away on holiday, but she said, you want to go and see Aphex Twin? You know what I mean? So it's like, that's what we were up to before the band.
So when Dry Cleaning were first formed, just to give a bit of background, Lewis, Tom and Nick, you guys were in a sort of a trio. Were you starting to try and form a band, or was it more just jamming and see where it went? Because I'm aware that Florence came a little bit after.
It was a band. We'd had what you hear on our first EP was what we'd written. We'd written songs, structures. Kind of is the template of how we work now. We kind of do the majority of the structuring of a song. And then Flo joined. After about 7 months, we realized these are three quarters of the way finished. we do need a singer, really. So that's when Plo joined. Yeah, and she finished them off. And then from that point on, we wrote together.
And what do you guys remember of those early encounters? Like I said, Flo was the last person to join. And I think I remember reading somewhere that she said it was sort of a bit unexpected for her. You know, she didn't sort of intend to be in a band. So what was that process like?
It was very relaxed, kind of like it still is now when we're kind of just jamming or writing. There's a lot of just chat and hanging out and kind of eating lunch and then just the odd bit of a jam. And but back then, I feel like it's even more so. We'd go indoors to play FIFA, and some days we kind of would do quite minimal amounts of music. And then, yeah, there was no ambition for the band. There was like, we didn't plan to gig ever. And we didn't even plan to ever release music. It was only when Christian, capital K, like, owed Nick a bit of a favor because Nick could play some drums for him, that Nick was like, I could get really cheap down in the studio. Should we document what we're doing at the moment? So we went in for one day, recorded the first EP in kind of just a few hours. And then even then, we weren't going to do anything with it. And it's only because Christian, his mate James, who plays in the band called Blue House, asked us, he showed it to him. He's like, oh, this is really good. And they should open for me at the Chapelwell in like a couple of weeks. So then we kind of put it online. And then we had some slight plan of maybe releasing it as a cassette. And then I think because they forgot to reply to some emails, that never happens. And then the kind of band started. And kind of people started to kind of notice. And it kind of went, it moved very quickly.
So what were your responses to that? Did you expect that level of attention?
In a way, no. But then when it did happen, it did make sense, if you know what I mean. You sort of like, oh, that's how it works. Just the feeling of the right thing at the right time. Right place, right time kind of thing. And it's like, as soon as we started moving, like playing shows, we got a booking agent and a manager. And as soon as we started to play shows, you sort of like, yeah, it just felt like, oh, I can see why this is kind of kicking off at the moment. Like the spoken word thing. I think the fact that like Flo appeared, do you know what I mean? Like, it's almost like the world wanted someone like Flo to come along. And it's like, we were just the ones to be in the band with her, so I think.
Well, you mentioned the Chapelwell Arms there, where you an early support slot. And I was just reading this morning about, you know, grassroots venues and what the kind of trends are at the moment. It sounds like things are maybe getting a little bit better than they were from sort of like 2023, 2024. But yeah, it just sort of shows you how important these venues are.
And there's so many people that work so hard to keep them alive.
Yeah.
Like every day of the week. So yeah, like huge respect. Like everyone starts there and you can kind of tell when someone hasn't.
Yeah, I mean, this is very London specific because Scared to Dance has always been predominantly in London. But, you know, we've been at the Chapelwell Arms for coming up to 11 years and the Victoria Dawson, and now we're going to the George Tavern and stuff like that. But, you know, all of those venues, and I think the Lexington's also an incredibly important venue for that, just a slightly bigger one, you know, yeah, just so integral to the whole scheme.
I think also that when I first moved to London about 25 years ago, and it was so much more like an ecology, an ecosystem then. Like it was so much easier to just wander into something and there'd be a gig in it.
Yeah.
And you think about places like Power Lunches, DIY Space for London. I mean, the club like you guys are talking about, Madame Jojo's and stuff like that, where you're kind of just out and then you sort of think like, oh, there's a gig over there. Whereas now it's like so much harder to just go out and find an amazing gig, do you know what I mean? Like, it's possible, and I think thanks to a lot of these people putting in the work at these small venues, it hasn't died. And I hope it is. Oh, you're right. I hope it is getting better. But I remember when I moved to London in like 2005, it was it was insanely diverse. Like,
and just going back to that early phase of Dry Cleaning again, the first album, New Long Leg, was made during the pandemic. How was that for you guys? That's not exactly ideal circumstances to record your debut album for 4AD.
We didn't know any better. Like, people kept asking us, what's it like to like record or release a record in the pandemic? But we'd never recorded and released a record like in a studio of that level, on a label of that level, with a producer of that level. So it was all new, so it kind of just felt new. And it didn't feel different. We got really lucky with some of our timings, kind of like accidentally. Like, we did a US tour, which we got cut short because of the pandemic, but it meant that for a lot of journalists in the States, we were the last bands they saw before the pandemic. And then things kept closing and opening, but we got lucky with the tour that we'd booked to come back happens. And we, so as a result, we'd be the first bands that a lot of those journalists would see again. And then when we recorded the record, it was the first time, it was like the first week you could actually go into that studio and record. And then when the record came out, it was the first week that record shops were open. There was like a lot of like things just lining up in a way that really kind of helped us.
And you worked with John Parrish at Rockfield Studios for the first two albums, New Long Leg and Stumpwork. He's got quite a list of people that he's worked with, PJ Harvey, Aldous Harding, Trace Chapman. How did that come about?
I think that was the label's suggestion, because he'd worked with Aldous, and I think they thought he'd be like a good person for a band to make their first record with, particularly because of COVID. So it's like weird circumstances, but also we only had 2 weeks to do it, so it's not long. We were doing like two songs a day, basically. So it did take quite a lot of management as well. Do you know what I mean? And I think they thought that he would. His wisdom and experience sort of think he would understand the lay of the landscape and sort of be the right choice, really. And when we spoke to him, the first time we spoke to him, really, you could sort of tell that, because he was already thinking practically. So what should you play live? You'll play live, and, you know, we'd be very practical about it, really. Because the first album was literally just the four of us, him and the engineer, Joe Jones. There was no one else around. Like, you know, we were cooking meals and stuff like that. So it did take some management, you know what I mean? Mm.
We had to ask, the reason why we went to a residential studio, what John liked working there, but also because we had to isolate, because it was still kind of like semi-pandemic-y times, and we was all trying to be careful. So that was kind of why we went to a residential studio, but then we kind of fell in love with one, and we've kind of done residential studios since. They really seemed to help us a lot.
Yeah, and you worked there again on the second album as well.
Yes, correct. Yeah.
And was that recorded live as well? And was it the same process, or did you sort of tweak a few things?
Pretty much. There was probably a bit more time on that one. So we were doing more overdubs and exploring some different soundscapes and stuff like that. But it's basically the same.
Yeah. The basic tracking would be all four of us in a room, like Nick behind like some sliding doors and amps in other rooms, but all of us, including Florence, performing at the same time. That's what like John is incredible at, of just capturing a band's how they sound and their performance. And you really trust him when you're performing as well. You can't really trust yourself while performing so much, because sometimes you're like, oh, this one's gone, like I've kind of lost this one, and then at the end you'll be like, that was the one, and then it kind of changes your perspective on it. And it is interesting just having those extra pair of ears, especially such a well-trained pair of ears.
Does that give you more confidence to try things then in the studio, if you're slightly second guessing your instinct and you've got that kind of safe pair of hands there? Does that, as musicians, does that give you maybe a little bit more license to try something?
Well, it's difficult to say with John, isn't it? Because it's like he was kind of working to a schedule and he sort of had the plan in his head of how he wanted it to be. So he'd give you an opportunity to try something, but I think if he wasn't convinced by it quickly, he would move on quite quickly as well. So
what was the track? Was it Conservative Hell, where me and you were jamming for like 20 minutes, just thinking about lunch and talking about lunch while jamming?
Yeah.
And if you came back into the room being like, sorry about that, guys. They're like, no, that's the take. You've got that, actually.
No. And also, we were saying, we think we know what we're going to do after lunch. And it was like 5 minutes to lunch. And he said, no, do it now. And it was like, okay. So, yeah. I don't know about with John, it's weird because, like, whether you're confident enough or not is kind of irrelevant with John. You just have to sort of, he wants you to get on with it, really.
So I've been listening to your excellent new album, Secret Love, which is out now. And the lead single, Hit My Head All Day, came out back in September. How is the process of releasing a new album for you guys?
It's great. Really enjoyed this one. We spent a lot more time working on this one than we did the other two. We had more time. I don't know. I feel like this is the one that I feel most represents us. This is kind of how I wanted us to sound at the beginning of the band. And I think to be able to share it now and see the reaction it's got is very pleasing.
Yeah, I was saying that yesterday. It represents, I think, people maybe were a bit confused on the first two records when they come to see us live, that we might be heavier, kind of leaning in certain directions, kind of sonically a bit more. And then I feel like new records captures that, kind of like Kate was kind of very playful with kind of going into certain areas and sometimes going in the opposite direction of where a song's leaning, but it kind of opens up, it kind of shows more of a wider palette that we kind of use live.
So you mentioned Kate there. That's Kate Le Bon, who's produced a new album, who I'm a huge fan of. So was having that more time with her quite a freeing thing then? I mean, you mentioned that people might be confused having listened to the first two records then seeing you live. Well, I was exactly like that. I remember seeing you at Moth Club and at festivals and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, right, they're going off in these sort of like 10-minute directions, you know, of like sort of like wigging out a bit. So did Kate sort of, having that more time with Kate, did that allow that to sort of manifest itself a bit more?
I'd say sonically, weirdly, like kind of back to John a bit, he kind of like would trim down the songs to such, like there'd be songs where we play maybe 6 minutes live, and then John would get it down to like 3 minutes, 44 minutes. That we kind of had that kind of like in our brains a bit. So before we started working with Kate, we kind of got the songs down to shorter, to the point where maybe she'd extend it, because we kind of just thought that's what you kind of have to do. You have to make it as short as possible and kind of like trim away all the fat. And so Kate didn't really mess with anything structurally, but apart from maybe extend stuff, but kind of sonically would really kind of pull out, yeah.
And what was the starting point for this album? How does a dry cleaning album come together?
We just jammed, really. I think we sort of accumulated something like over 100 jams, basically, which won the gamut of like, Secret Love was pretty well formed quite quickly. Joy came along pretty much as it is immediately. And then it goes all the other way to things that are like sort of like 25 minutes of utter nonsense, you know what I mean? Like, and then there's things like I Need You, which were like jams where we all just tried different things, tried to do something different. So we had like over 100 of those. And then the process from there was demoing them. And that required us to sort of, we had to be a bit more selective about what we were going to work on, because you can't work on, we sort of thought like, okay, we're going there for a week. What should we work on? So we sort of trim it down to like 6 or 8 songs. So there's a lot of listening involved back to the demo, which is really arduous, actually. It's really tiring because you're just like paying attention, trying to think like, is this something we think has potential, you know? So there isn't really sort of like, it's hard to say when there's an actual beginning point, because you are also accumulating little riffs and little things that you, maybe there's something you've heard in one of our songs that you want to work on more, you know, or do more like that. I think it's fair to say that when we first did the session at Lost in Chicago was when it felt like it really began, because we came out of that week in Chicago with 6 like really good demos, and one of which was like Half Pint. We also had Let Me Grow and You'll See the Fruit. We also had The Cute Things. And so they felt like, oh, these are kind of like, these feel that they could be like singly type cornerstones of a record. So from that point on, it's just a case of fleshing it out, just keep going, try and get as many good songs that can make them as rich as possible, really. Do you know what I mean?
we kept booking in these studio times to kind of like give ourselves time limits. Because we're just always jamming, and we really enjoyed the whole process of it. But having like when we went to Chicago, there was like maybe like 1 or 2-ish structured songs, but a lot of them were kind of just like slight jams. And we kind of had that every time we went to those different 3 to 4 different studios, kind of was just to get some ideas kind of like into place. And it kind of worked really well. And we worked well to a deadline.
So what's the division of labor in dry cleaning? Am I right in thinking that you guys plus Nick are coming up with the music, and then Florence comes with the lyrics? Does she put them on top of your jams, or does it work the other way around?
Well, basically that's it, yeah. But Flo's there when we're writing, and it's not really, nothing really happens until everyone is feeling it, you know what I mean? Like we can write something and Flo's like, I'm just not feeling that. Mm. So even though she's maybe not writing lyrics or singing particularly presently, it doesn't, she's still thinking like, that's really giving me ideas. She talks about when we first were writing Evil Idiot, and she was like, the riff on it had like enough character for her the character of it, like, it would just give me her loads of ideas, sort of thing. So we can feel like we could, she would communicate that to us, and then we'll sort of start moving in that direction. But generally, yeah, we sort of come up with the structures first, and then Flo is writing to that. But then when we start to hear the vocals, when we're demoing, you can then edit and sort of change it from there, sort of, and try and find ways. The thing I like about working in the studio when you're making the finished album is that you start to think about how you can maximize what's there. So you can sort of add and take away things to maximize what Flo's doing, and vice versa. You sort of think, like, I remember there's the solo at the end of Half Pint. I think it came up like, maybe don't sing there, just let the solo go. So the music takes off a little bit. You know what I mean? So I think that is also quite a big thing, is like, you want to make space for Flo, but Flo at times also makes space for the music to bloom a little bit and kick off. Like you say, particularly in a live show, you want to go for it a bit more musically. You know what I mean?
I had this realization in the last couple of weeks that what works about Dry Cleaning is it's four really stubborn people refusing to kind of like meet someone in the middle, like genre wise or where they're coming from with their instrument. But what we do is we're really respectful about space. So even though you're kind of like, oh, you're doing that riff, I'm going to bring this vibe to it, or you're doing this beat, I'm going to do this vibe to it, you kind of like, I'm going to do that, but I'm going to allow you a lot of space to really go within what you're doing. I'm not going to kind of like smother you or kind of like give you a small area. I've like definitely had that bands in the past where I'd be the bass player, but it'd be like two keyboard players who are both playing keyboard bass. And you're like, there's no room. There's no problem even adding anything. I feel like in Dry Cleaning, everyone gets like almost unlimited, as much room as they can to kind of forge for their parts, which is really like rewarding. And it's a nice way of writing.
That's what I was wondering. How does that work in the studio if you're four quite stubborn individuals? Is there the space to say, if Florence doesn't like a riff and she tells you, or you don't like a lyric and it goes the other way? How does that play out?
Well, I think it's only stubborn in the sense that you're into what you're doing. It's not stubborn in the sense that I refuse to change. You know what I mean? It's not like if you're bringing some guitar parts in and you're showing them to people and they're not really reacting to it, you can't be like, guys, pay attention here, I've written a hit. You just have to take it in your stride, really. And just like, because I think we all rely on the fact when all four of us are really into something, that's when it's good. So to push your idea, if it's not clicking, is pointless. You know, it doesn't really get me to that point where everyone is really vibing on something. So if someone says they don't like something, even if it just feels a bit like kind of hurts your feelings or something, it doesn't really matter, because you sort of think like it's only they're literally just saying how they feel. If they don't like it, it's like you just move on, you know. And I think sometimes that's why we end up having quite a lot of really catchy parts, because the filtering process just gets rid of so many things. Like, I've definitely been in projects before where you sort of like, if not a lot of ideas come up, so you cling to them a lot more. You think, I have to make this work. Whereas we don't really do that. We sort of like, even if you're really vibing on something, it's not picking, you just move on. Like I say, we had like over 100 demos. Like, you don't get to that number of demos unless you move quickly. If you're too precious about something, you're just going to get stuck in the mud.
So it's definitely more about the four of us all liking something rather than someone having to kind of like argue a case or one person not liking it. There'll always be 20 to 30 songs within an album jam cycle where everyone's like, I want to carry on with these ones. And to the point where we always have too many when we go to the studio, and we have to kind of like bring it down to an amount where it's actually workable.
And are there any sort of themes that you think you sort of coalesce around, either musically or in terms of flow lyrically? You know, do the songs on Secret Love, are they connected to each other in a narrative way, or do they sort of exist separately in emotional spaces?
I'd say separately, because it's actually it's written over such a vast period of time where it would be kind of separate, but then kind of brought together as a piece of music that works as an album. You kind of, it's a fun part when you record and you have spare songs. So the album isn't the 10, 11, 12, whatever tracks that are your favorites. It's just the body of work that works as an album the best. So it will kind of paint a new picture, all those like individual songs.
On this album, I feel like there are maybe more softer, more spacious moments on this third album. How do you approach the dynamics and the restraint in the studio towards that? Is that something that's considered in advance, or something that sort of plays out when it's the four of you in the room?
we've always sort of acknowledged that space in the songs is something we really want to do, if you know what I mean. Like, because especially as a listener, you sort of want some moments of breathing space on an album. And I think we've also been quite keen to sort of be an album band where you sort of, it's like a journey almost. If you think of it that way, you do need moments of like calm and space. I think about a song like Rocks, it's so intense. I've listened to it the other day. There's so many things going on. By the end of it, you do need something else. Like, there's a little block of songs there, and then I Need You. And it feels like you do need something to sort of like take your foot off the gas. But also at the same time, I think about the spaciousness of our songs. And I also think we could make an album of that, if you know what I mean. Like, I don't think we're wedded to any type of songwriting. I think we just sort of like, you just, as you're making a body of songs, you're sort of trying to sort of just feel your way through it. And if they're all going one particular direction, I think we would just go with it, really.
You also, when you're a band, and bands like myself, Tom and Nick had been in, where you're playing a 30-minute set, maximum a 40-minute set, and you're kind of releasing more like EPs, you don't have much of a range that you can kind of fit in that space. But when you start playing like hour-long sets and making albums, and now we're playing like an hour and 20-minute long sets, you kind of want the dynamics within the set, and you can kind of ride a set more. A front of house will kind of ride the set dynamically out front as well, and you get to kind of have more of a narrative during a set or an album. So you kind of want to take advantage of that.
Are there any sonic references for you guys on this album? You know, is there anything particularly from your record collection that you've kind of leaned into?
Yeah, but there's sort of like dozens of little things, you know what I mean, as opposed to any sort of one big thing. I think we were talking a lot about Bowie and Lou Reed in their German period, the Berlin years. We were listening to a guy called Peace de Resistance, who's like a New York musician. He made a couple of records that are like really referencing that time. We really like that kind of stuff. That was a big reference. There was, for me personally, I've been really listening to a lot of Stone over the last few years and trying to bring that into my playing a lot more, trying to get more like, if you're thinking of a song like Half Pint, My Soul Half Pint, you sort of get a vibe going and just keep moving around a rhythm. Like, me and Lewis are sort of, it's like a conversation between the riffs. And try to do a bit more of that. I'll tell you what else, Louis.
Towards the end, we kept going for Party. It's kind of like, and that kind of like Stones kind of vibe was something we're trying to capture. Like, we never make a plan. It's the closest we got to making a plan in that writing, that demoing writing period. But we started doing rehearsals, which were shorter, like 4 hour long. Like, we wouldn't take a lunch break. We just kind of plowed through, kind of like we would have done in the first EPs, to try kind of get more of like a high energy party kind of vibe.
And were there any non-musical influences that shaped the album in any way? Do you guys, I guess that maybe is more of a question for Flo, but just in terms of your guys playing, you know, what other influences feed in that are perhaps not actually musical?
Well, I think film is probably quite a big one. Yeah. We watch because we fly a lot, so we get to watch lots of films. And then when we're home, you're sort of... whenever we're not on tour, you end up being at home when everyone's at work. So you sort of live this weird life where you sort of go to the cinema and there's no one in it.
It's the best time to go to the cinema.
I completely agree.
It's cheap. Yeah. It's just you and like 10 retired people who are just eating their biscuits. They've got it down. Everyone's quiet. Everyone's respectful. And it's cheap.
I spent a lot of my adult life in daytime cinemas watching films. Which ended up being an extension to Scared to Dance because we have the film night now. But so it's funny how these things play out. And were there any ideas that you experimented with that didn't make the album?
Yeah, we've got like three songs that we're going to bring out after. They kind of deserve to be on it, but we went through a variety of track listings and we felt like what we ended up with was the most cohesive. One of them is called Sliced by a Fingernail, which went through a lot of variations. We worked on that at the Loft, and we worked on that in Dublin with the guys from Guinevere, Alan and Dan from Guinevere. And then we worked on it with Kate, and it was kind of the one of the ones we were sort of like really pushing it for it to be like actually heavy, you know what I mean? Not that it's a heavy song all the way through. It's probably the most loud, quiet dynamic of anything we've done. And it's got some weird industrial technique going through it as well. So it's kind of like, it was a song we felt like we had to convince people that we want to do it like this. I think it was kind of like people think like, the difficult thing about working with some producers is when, or engineers, whatever, is when they think they know who you are. Obviously, we're all thinking about Deftones, or do you know what I mean? We're talking about like, well, we want to go that heavy. And they sort of do their approximation of that heavy, but we're like, no, we really do want to go that heavy. And it wasn't until we started working with Guinevere in Dublin that we did that. So we're quite excited for that to come out, actually, because that was definitely a theme going to that degree of heaviness that we haven't before.
It's also nice to work with someone like Guinevere, who just normalize extreme noise more than we do. Like, we all listen to, like, the four of us, it's quite noisy music, but like, they listen to very noisy music, but also kind of like 50 Cent, but they're trying to pick random references. But while working together, you'd be like, is that a bit too much? They're like, no, that's really poppy. That's really nice. Kind of, it's quite nice to go to those extremes.
So those three songs that are going to come out, are they going to be singles or just on like a mini EP or something?
One's going to be a swipe by a fingernail. I think it's going to be a single, isn't it?
Yeah. And we're kind of working out how to release the others. Yeah.
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 There's like various ways of doing it. We kind of learned in the past. If you kind of split it out as an EP, people think it's a new recording, extra recordings. We also don't want it to look like they were songs that were left off the album because we didn't like them. It's kind of not the case at all. It's more, we were just trying to pick the songs that made the album the best album. So yeah, you kind of want to show that you really care about them and you like them. But yeah, you kind of, it's a difficult one because we're working out to do it.
I think one of the standout tracks on the album is Let Me Grow and You'll See the Fruit, which is a superb title, by the way. I wonder if you could just talk me through how that song was written.
Just the process we've described, really. I sort of brought the guitar parts to practice. And I think it was probably Nick who clicked with it the most immediately. I think he liked the sort of 70s funk aspect of it, sort of like pentangle and things like that. So he immediately started to play quite a bouncy kind of drum part to it. And then I don't think we really worked on it much until we got to the Loft and we did it there. And it seemed to Lewis put his bass line down on it and it sort of unfloated the vocal and it just coalesced quite quickly, really. And I think we thought that was some of the stuff, I think songs like that and songs like I Need You were things that we were starting to dig, but these are the keystones of the album, really, because they are what we really like. It's like us bringing different sound, like different influences and just a different aspect of our personalities into the band. So we held that one up quite highly and it didn't really change until we got to work on it with Kate.
And how did that come about? How did you end up working with Kate? I believe Jeff Tweedy from Wilco had something to do with it.
We played Pitchfork Festival a few years ago and Jeff Tweedy was backstage. And someone in our team was like, Jeff Tweedy's backstage, he wants to say hello. And so we're like, fuck yeah. So then we met Jeff and then he was like, next time you're in Chicago, you should come down to the studio. And I can't remember if it was the same trip or was back a few months later.
It was a few days later.
We popped into the Loft and Kate was there producing the Wilco record Cousin. And we didn't know that they were recording. We just kind of were just going to say hello. So we just hung out for like half hour, an hour, kind of saw the studio, saw how cool it was. It's the first time we'd all met Kate, so kind of that was cool as well. And then I think that kind of just put the idea in our head slightly when, in a year's time or so, when we had to start picking a producer, just kind of like seed had been sown a bit.
And Kate has a great list of credits now as a producer. It's got Horse Girl, John Grant, Kurt Vile, H. Hawkline. Was there a particular record of hers that made you want to work with her? I mean, I think of someone like Devendra Banhart's Flying Wig album, and I think you can really hear her impact. I think there is a Kate Le Bon sound, and of the albums that she's produced, I think that Devendra Banhart one is probably her biggest imprint.
That Horse Girl record had just come out when we were chatting, and it's great. It's really good.
Yeah.
That was definitely one for me that kind of put Kate high on the list.
Yeah. But for me, actually, not so much. I'm not like, I liked Marker Museum that she made. I got that when it came out, and I didn't really explore much more of Kate's music or production, but I respect what I really admire what she does, and I'm not really so much of a fan. It was more me talking to her for the first time. You could tell she was on the same wavelength, sort of thing.
And Lewis, you mentioned the Horse Girl album. I think that is a very good use of space, if you think of how much space there is on that album. That was one of my favourite albums of the year.
Yeah, agreed.
And so how was it working with her? You recorded it in France, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. A place called Black Box Studios, kind of on the northern edge in the Loire Valley. It was great working with her. I really enjoyed working with her. She's really good at, she kind of describes things to you and then lets you get on with it. So she's not so much where John would be like, you'd be doing things and he'd say, come and have a listen. Or he'd say, no. Kate was much more like, give it a go. And I said, let's see what we end up with. She was a bit more flexible in that way. There's definitely a few things that I was like really keen to try that she didn't like the sound of, but she let me try it anyway. And then she would help work it out and it would sound good. And if she liked it, it would go on, sort of thing. So she was very collaborative. She was like, she was the leader, but she was collaborative at the same time.
It came out from such an emotional point of view as well. Like from, we had like a bit of a list of producers who we would just like Zoom and FaceTime or whatever. And a lot of them would kind of just sit in their studios and be like, I've got this rack unit. Kind of like, I've got this synth, I've got this mic. Can you be like, okay, cool. And they're kind of like, I'd like to work here. I like this. And it was kind of like just a bit boring. And like Kate, and like they'd kind of listened to, at that point we had like 18 like well-recorded, like releasable demos. And Kate didn't talk about gear, didn't talk about studios, kind of just came in from like an emotional point of view of her understanding the songs, we'd like briefly chatted at that point about we liked how, because we was aware that all the demos sounded quite different to each other. Because not just because they'd been recording different studios and with different people, but kind of like even the genres we were leaning into, there's all quite different sonically and also how we was playing. And we was kind of a bit worried about how that could come together. And Kate just saw it instantly as the thing that made the album. She was like, it's like walking through a city, kind of like, I see it's like walking through a city. And that's the only thing that we were trying to achieve at that point. So and she understood it so quickly. It seemed, that was extremely cool that she kind of recognized that. And that's maybe what you want in a producer. You want them to recognize something within you before you do. Kind of they kind of understand what you want.
And of those 18 songs, were there any that she particularly had like a big impact on?
Probably Cruise Ship Designer was the one which had the most impact on, because it was really just Ide and Jan that Florence edited down into a little structure and put the vocals on and included it in the 18. And I think the three of us were like, quite a lot of parts, but I couldn't even remember how to play some of it. And then when Kate heard it, she said, it's like the best song. Like, we were like, if you say so, you're the boss. Like, it's nearly dinner. And she was like, she said something, it's like, this is what I mean about when she describes things in a way that makes you want to do it. She said, when I imagine coming to see you play live, this is the song you're playing. And I remember thinking, like, that's a really good way of saying it. Because she's not like coercing you. She's just kind of like putting an image in your head. Obviously, like, that was like, I thought about that image. I was like, I'm going to give it my best shot. And it was such a weird, but we sat recording it. It's like, Bowen Florence came up with like a graph, like a chart of how to play it. I even had like my phone, and it's like, after 2 minutes, go to Belgium, which is like some kind of, it was like a trigger word for going mental, basically, at the end of the song. And she was just getting me to improvise. I think I did like 3 or 4 improvised layers, and she just chopped them up. It was such a weird process, like, but she took that from being 50-50, really going to be a song or not, to being a single. Quite a big journey, really.
I think we were also scarred from the initial jam, which you couldn't hear in the jam, that Nick was playing keyboards and it was painfully loud because there was that pointing at everyone apart from him. So anytime he was playing the sound, it was like, So everyone, like, I wrote off that jam because I remember being in such pain and my ears were home from it.
And on Cruise Ship Designer, there's a great video for it. And all of the songs on the album being choreographed by Bully Ake. How did you end up working with them?
That was just we had the idea to do dancing for the album, for the, like, basically for every song to have like a dancing visualizer. But we also had to acknowledge, the reason why we wanted to do that was because it was out of our comfort zone, basically. We hadn't done anything like that before. We were just looking for some different elements from this record, you know what I mean? Just try different things. But we also had to admit that none of us are dancers at all. So the brief really was that we wanted it to be something that our fans could easily do, that we could easily do. So that's why we approached Bully Ake. I think Flo was already following them. And I think one of them lives in a house with somebody who works at our publishing company.
Yeah, that's right.
Warp. So it was really just a crossing of paths, really. It's like one of those serendipitous things at the right moment, at the right time. As you can see the results, they did a really good job.
Well, we should add that it is Lewis in the video for Cruise Ship Designer doing the dance.
Oh, is that you?
It's me. Hey.
How was that, Lewis?
I was so nervous. Like, doing it on my own, I found really uncomfortable and, like, embarrassing. And it was only... I had to ask my housemate to sit in the living room with me while I did it because I found it so painful. But then I'm not sure what it says about me. Probably a good question for a therapist. Of, like, when I performed it in the room with, like, two camera people... two people from the label, Nick from the band was there. I found it so easy. And I did a few takes and they'd be like, I think we've got it now. I'd be like, no, I could do another one. And I got way too into it. I got way too involved and I was enjoying it way too much, but I couldn't do it on my own. I found it too cringe to do on my own.
So perhaps your exhibitionist side creeping out.
Yeah, maybe. Or just, I like to publicly humiliate myself.
I have a real fondness for the song, The Cute Things. It's one of my favourite tracks on the album. It really kind of knocked me out the first time I listened to the album. I thought it really stood out. Is that kind of softer approach something you would like to take on in the future? Because I always think of Dry Cleaning, particularly when I see you live, you just sort of lean into the kind of their heavier stuff. But I think, you know, you are a fantastic band that can do things very delicately.
Yeah, it's weird. I think from the very beginning, I think we've always thought of ourselves as kind of like a pop band. When I think of the pop music we grew up with, it's like it didn't really have a sort of barrier between whether it was heavy or not. So take, for instance, like Nirvana. Like when I think of Nirvana, it's still like In Bloom, it's really heavy. It's still pop music. When I listen to like the classic era of Metallica, the choruses are absolutely incredible. It's pop music to me. So I think we don't draw a barrier between whether something's heavy or not. The key is to write pop music, really. So when The Cute Things came up, like to me, The Cute Things is quite heavy because it's so rhythmically, so much drive in it. And also the chord structure is quite strong, whereas usually I might do something a bit more spindly. This is like, you know what I mean? It's quite like, again, more Keith Richards-y, I suppose. So to me, that is quite heavy. So I think what we're trying to do is just make more pop music, you know what I mean? And the thing I like about that song is it's got a really banging chorus. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I think we were thinking, when it came up, we thought it sounded like Sheryl Crow. You know, A Change Will Do You Good?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or the other one. I realized the bass line I was playing was exactly the same as one of her bass lines, like the same key, the same rhythm, absolutely the same bass line, which absolutely. I wasn't mad about. I was kind of quite enjoying it. But I was like, I'm not sure I can get away with that.
I think we agonized about it a little bit, but then we led into it. We were like, yeah. I think Dry Cleaning, because we had those heavier moments and those more abstract moments and stuff like that, I feel like we all feel quite comfortable leaning into something really accessible and poppy. Do you know what I mean? Because we want people to enjoy listening to the music.
And we also, I think we're really good at reacting to environments and we rehearse early days on the EPs, we rehearsed in like a tiny, tiny garage. And then one of our rehearsal rooms we used for Secret Love was very small, like very, very small. But another one was kind of like where we keep our equipment is quite large. And then our gigs vary so much as well. Like the year before last, we was on a Nick Cave tour, but we'd also just re-released the EPs. So we're doing venues that we would have played around the release of the EPs. So kind of like 300 to 600 capacity kind of size venues. And then a few weeks later, playing to 20,000 people in Amsterdam and kind of and playing similar kind of sets or kind of trying to make a set from the songs we have. So there's always such extremes in what in kind of what we do and where we're doing it. I feel like we're good at adapting to that and kind of writing for those different environments.
Well, early in the series on the podcast, I spoke to Warren Ellis about a film that came out last year. How was that tour for you, touring with Nick Cave? Because, you know, that you're regularly in front of about 10,000 people or more.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. It was really fun. I didn't expect it to be so fun. I think we were a little bit like, how are we going to work in an arena?
Yeah.
But then as soon as you get there and you sound check, you realize it sounds amazing. But the audio, the sort of, the amp system they brought with them was so potent. But it wasn't really like playing in an arena, but also quite a large portion of his fans watched our set every day. They travel around, like hundreds and thousands, a few thousand even would travel to every show. So you'd sort of see the same faces maybe rotating their position in the front line of the crowd. So, and they were really into it. They're very generous. And they sort of, so it was actually, yeah, it was really fun. And also just like the aspect of you get there at like 4, you sort of chill out for a bit, and then like you go to the canteen and have food, and the food was insanely good. So it's like kind of like support shows are really good because there's not a lot of pressure.
Yeah,
so you're just there to play your set, chuck to a few new ones here and there, and you just try to enjoy the experience really. Yeah. And then you could see Nick Cave. I watched Nick Cave's full set like 5 to 6 times. So it was like, yeah, really fun experience.
It was cool to see an artist of his size with a band of so many like profession, like highly, like some of like the best musicians in the world still get better during a tour. And like they really worked it, and kind of to see Nick Cave in soundcheck. One, he was there for soundcheck. I think a lot of people in his situation wouldn't be there. He was there for every soundcheck, and he would mimic how he'd be performing in the show. Like he really cared about his performance, and he really cared about how he engaged with the crowd, and that amount of care, I think, really goes into the show. But yeah, the whole band kind of got better and better like over the 3 weeks he was on the tour, which is kind of cool to see, because you expect something like that just to be watertight from the first gig and to come out and be perfect, and it was fucking great from the first gig, but just got better and better and better.
Well, speaking of bigger gigs, you're playing at Brixton Academy later this year. How exciting is that for you guys, particularly as a South London band?
That's the one.
Yeah, it's the one.
It's the one. I just can't really put it any other way, you know? It's like, I saw Deftones there when I was a kid. It was like, it's also, Brixton is like the best because it's kind of intimate, it's massive. It's like 6,000 people. But when you're in there, because of the way the floor is sloped, and then it goes, it's almost like everybody's right in front of you. Mm. But it's like widescreen, and then it sort of goes up. And it's like, yeah, I've seen so many great shows there. So to be doing it does feel like it's the one you want to tick off, you know? Like there'd been others along the way, like the Forum. I wanted to play the Forum a lot. I always thought that was a great venue. But the top of the tree is definitely the Brixton Academy. It's the best.
Has this been on the dry cleaning bucket list for a long time then?
We were meant to do it when we did the Roundhouse, but it's that period of time when Brixton closed after there's an incident there. So we had to rearrange it to the Roundhouse, which I was also happy about, because the Roundhouse is a great venue and a great charity. I was kind of really happy to play there. But it's kind of nice to kind of do all those steps of the London venues to kind of, Electric Ballroom to like Forum to Roundhouse to Brixton, and kind of going around London, and kind of Brixton, like Tom said, is the big one for us. Not just capacity, as in just because of like the shows we've seen there.
And is there anywhere else on the tour that you're particularly looking forward to playing?
The one I'm looking forward to playing is the Sydney Opera House, which I'm not sure has been announced.
Oh shit! Yeah, yeah.
That's a biggie.
That's a biggie as well.
Yeah.
And just wrapping things up. we always ask on the podcast, is there an album in the last 12 months that you could recommend to the listeners?
I'm listening to a record by a guy in Georgia, in Atlanta. No, hang on, Georgia. Where is Georgia? That is the state.
Yeah.
It's called Calvary, and it's kind of like this like weird black metal project, but it's the drummer used to be in a band called Merchandise that were on 4AD as well. But it sounds a bit like Ian Curtis, but not resurrected. He's still dead, but he's singing in this band.
Mm-hmm.
And it's black metal.
Well,
I think it's the last time I could possibly say it, because I think it came out exactly a year ago, but the Yahweh Nalgum record, I've rinsed in every interview.
This is probably the last time you'll be able to say that.
I know, yeah. I feel like today is potentially exactly a year since it came out, so I'm going to use it one more time. Because I have seen them live like 5-6 times in the past couple of years, and I think they're great. And they're supporting us on tour around the States. But yeah, now I need to listen to something else current.
Give that Calvary album a go.
Oh yeah, we'll do it. Yeah.
Well, Lewis and Tom, thank you so much for joining me today, and good luck on the tour. Thanks to Lewis Maynard and Tom Dowse from Dry Cleaning for joining me today. Their new album Secret Love is out now on 4AD, and they're heading out on tour in April and May. The Skatedance Club Night is back on Saturday when we have our first event at the legendary George Tavern. The final few tickets are available on Dice. And I'll be back next week with my guest is Gweno. I'll be talking to her about her creative process, writing and performing in the Welsh and Cornish languages, plus her latest album, Utopia. This podcast was produced at Third Floor Recording.